I'm Jana Marin, and you're listening to Season 2 of More to the Story, the podcast that's all about creative nonfiction and the power of sharing your personal story.
Tell me a story. Tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you.
Welcome to Season 2, Episode number 13 of More to the Story, a show that is all about something near and dear to my heart, telling true stories and sharing them with the world. In addition to this podcast, I also publish a literary magazine called Under the Gum Tree, which is dedicated to creative nonfiction and visual art. The magazine is published quarterly in digital and print. If you enjoy the readings on this show, I encourage you to check out the complete stories by purchasing a single issue or getting a subscription. Your purchase directly supports the work of the writers and artists we publish. Digital subscriptions are $2 a month and print subscriptions are $7 a month. All that info is online at underthegumtree.com. On today's episode of More to the Story, I'm joined by Dorian Fox, one of Under the Gumtree's previous contributors. Dorian's essays, articles, and stories have appeared in December, Gastronomica, Alimentum, Monkey Bicycle, National Parks Magazine, and elsewhere. His work has also been shortlisted for awards by Plowshares, Phoebe, and the Bellingham Review. He received his MFA in creative nonfiction from Emerson College and teaches writing at Grub Street in Boston. His essay, The Other First, appears in the January 2016 issue of Under the Gumtree. Before we get to the interview, here is Dorian reading an excerpt from his essay titled Summer 35.
So I'm going to be reading just an excerpt from the middle of a short essay called Summer 35. Back when I worked at a bakery, one of my very young coworkers, she was 18, doing a gap year before college, said she'd heard that when you turn 30, your body stops regenerating and starts to decompose. I don't know if there's any scientific basis for this. Probably not. By then, I was already 30, and she knew this, so I'm not sure how I was expected to respond. In any case, I laughed. I said, "That makes sense." We were rolling cold pucks of pie dough into thin pancakes, dusting the table with clouds of flour. The bakery had no air conditioning, and in the summer it was always a race to roll the circles and slide them on trays into the fridge before the butter in the dough melted, changing its consistency, dooming the final baked product, a tart, a quiche, to be less flaky and perfect. After my coworker introduced her theory, I made jokes about it often. "Don't mind me, I'm just rotting from the inside out." Like that. It was easy to be okay with decomposing because I didn't feel like I was decomposing. I was used to standing for 8 hours a day and lifting industrial mixing bowls and 50-pound sacks of flour. I felt strong. I'm 35 now, and if my body is in a state of decay, I'm not sure what to do about it. I still like the notion of a sudden turning point, a hard reversal clearly marked on the timeline of life. Happy 30th birthday. Physically, it's all downhill from here. You knew it was coming. Cut and dried. But lately, it does feel like my body is breaking down, muscles softening to jello, cells wilting. So the idea is less charming than it used to be. Maggie and I were walking back to the car. This was 3 years ago, maybe four, when we were leaner and less tired, and her sister hadn't yet died. Those things all seem related to me now, though I'm not sure that they are, or if they are, how. Grief is another kind of reversal, another kind of breakdown. We'd gone for iced coffees at a cafe in a crowded square. It was summer then, too, bodies everywhere. Exposed skin and tattoos and sweat. I must have seemed frustrated or quiet, and so Maggie asked me why. I said, "Because it's summer and I want to fuck everything." Not the kind of thing I would normally say, but as I said it, I imagined her laughing in response. I really did. She did not laugh. She made a face like she'd smelled something awful and said, "I don't like that." Of course she didn't like it. She didn't like it any more than I liked hearing about her past sexual partners, people she didn't really care to discuss, but who I'd press her to talk about sometimes out of masochistic curiosity. Like the guy who said dirty things in bed that I could never say, even if I wanted to, even if she wanted me to. Did she want me to? And who figured heavily in an argument during which I put my fist into the kitchen wall. Another thing I don't normally do, that I hadn't done before and haven't done since, but there it is. One of Maggie's paintings fell when I did it, which made me feel worse, though the canvas was fine. The wall is pale green, and the dent is still there, like a spoon mark pressed into the meat of an avocado. When I made my dumb comment about fucking, it was still early in our relationship, but we'd grown more honest and bold with each other, and I thought we might have been past that phase, past being hurt by ghosts, past punching walls. I think I was able to communicate something to that effect eventually. I realize none of what's above is especially romantic. Love might be a catgut string, always on the verge of snapping. For a long time, I resisted emojis. I put them in the same category as, say, never employing capital letters in your correspondence. At best, a lazy shortcut. At worst, in poor taste. I'm not a very outward person. I suspect that had more to do with it than anything. Now, in those green and blue text bubbles, I emote like hell. Maggie gets most of the action. I end messages to her with a red heart, or a green heart, or a yellow winking face blowing a kiss that is also a heart. I send her the thumbs up. I send her the stylized sun. I send her the wide-eyed blushing face. I send her the four-leaf clover. I send her the smiling poop. I type, "on my way," and insert a blue car that looks a lot like our car, adding a few puffs of wind behind it to suggest my speed. I type, "going to make like a baby," and head out, and include an image of a baby's head with a curly-cue lock of hair. And don't get me started on what's for dinner. Anyway, you know what I mean. It's fun. So I'll stop there.
I was muting myself so that you weren't distracted by my giggles there at the end. Thank you, Dorian, and welcome to More to the Story.
Yeah, thank you very much for having me. I'm really glad to be on.
So let's start with a little bit about your background as a writer and how you came to your interest in creative nonfiction as a genre.
Okay, well, I've written for, you know, like most writers, I've written for as long as I can remember, from a very young age. And I was an English major in college at Boston University, really tried even during those years to, you know, to sort of hone my craft and get better at writing. And after a few years, after graduating and after a few years of working in publishing and at a bookstore, I decided to get my MFA. And I was torn actually at first about, you know, whether I would apply to write fiction or creative nonfiction. But I almost had kind of a gut feeling that I was more of a creative nonfiction writer. I think because I, you know, just feel more comfortable grounding my work in my own experience. And so that's what I ended up applying for, and got into Emerson College and got my MFA there. And, I've been writing mostly creative nonfiction ever since, and some journalism as well.
Mm-hmm. When you say you're drawn to grounding your writing in your own experience, I still want to probe a little deeper into that, because I think fiction writers would say that they do the same thing. So what is it specifically about the nonfiction genre that is more compelling for you?
Yeah, well, that's actually a good point. Yeah, and I bet you're right that a lot of people would take issue with that. But I guess what I mean is that I like, in my writing, to kind of drop that veil of, you know, even if you are, you know, writing in an autobiographical way, but presenting it as fiction, there is a kind of veil there. And, you know, I like the kind of nakedness that comes with saying, this is my experience. It actually did happen to me. And also I think the challenge of knowing that you have to stick to the facts, and that when you, you know, you, when you're maybe tempted, you know, like as a fiction writer might be, to kind of dress up a situation or dramatize it, in a more, extreme way, you know, creative nonfiction writers aren't allowed to do that. You know, unless we somehow let the reader know that we're kind of taking a departure into like an imaginative scene or a speculative scene, right? So, so I like that challenge of, you know, and I found that as well in journalism too, you know, which it can be a real challenge to sort of stick to the facts and try to make a story as interesting as you can without ever departing from, you know, what is true, you know, what is factual mm-hmm. on the ground.
Mm-hmm. Do you ever find that the facts hang you, like trip you up when you're writing, and what, like, how do you overcome that?
Yeah, I do. I mean, there have been an awful lot of times where, you know, I'm writing about my own life and I'm just thinking, this isn't interesting enough. How do I make this more interesting? You know, I come from a background that is, you know, solidly middle class, like, or even upper middle class. I grew up in the suburbs outside of Pittsburgh. It was a wonderful place to grow up, but it was a fairly safe place to grow up. My family was pretty solid and pretty secure, and so, you know, I remember, especially in grad school, trying to write about my family and thinking, wow, I mean, compared to so many of the, you know, the nonfiction narratives I've read, you know, I felt as if, you know, my story maybe wasn't interesting enough, you know, to sustain itself as, you know, a book length memoir or a, you know, a series of personal essays. And I had to sort of get over that. So I think, you know, I think partly it's about, revision, you know, revising, and revising until you hone a story, and the voice of a story to the point where it's as honest, I think, as you can get it, but also as engaging, and tight, you know, as you can get it. So it's holding the reader's attention. Mm-hmm. But I think, you know, also just feedback is hugely helpful, because some, you know, some parts of our lives maybe aren't interesting enough to become an essay, to be an interesting essay. And so we need other people's eyes on our work, you know, and sometimes you're writing about something that you think is very interesting, and, you know, a trusted reader will look at it and say, oh, this really isn't doing it for me. But there's this one sentence that you kind of glossed over, right? That seems like the kernel of a much more interesting story, at least to an objective reader. And so, yeah, I think a feedback loop can be really helpful as we're trying to, like, sort through the raw material of our own lives mm-hmm. and pick out the good stuff.
Mm-hmm. What do you tell your students when they ask questions about things like, well, because we're talking about facts, you know, what, you know, how can you verify that you are being factual?
Yeah.
I get those questions frequently, because that those things often trip up new writers in particular. They're so concerned about being 100% accurate rather than just getting the story down on the page and looking for the thread or the focus of the story that may not necessarily be dependent on, say, facts per se.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, so in other words, the, how do you encourage students to embrace their own subjective version of the truth?
Right. Exactly.
Their own subjective truth, their own personal truth. Yeah, that can be difficult, because I think, You're right that oftentimes, especially when nonfiction writers are just starting out and trying to grapple with their experience on the page, they can be hamstrung by this idea that, oh, I have to get every fact right, and if I don't, I'm lying, right? But the fact is, even though the goal in nonfiction writing is to, stick to the facts as you see them. Because I mean, I think as personal essayists, we're not exactly journalists, right? I mean, there's some overlap there, but we're absolutely entitled as creative nonfiction writers and personal essayists to honor our own subjective version of our truth, right? And get that down on the page as best we can. So I try to explain that to students so they feel sort of empowered to kind of write the world through their own lens. But at the same time doing their best to certainly not to exaggerate or lie, but to get the details, the specific details that they can pin down. And sometimes it does take research or interviewing other people who have experienced something with you or alongside you, right? To nail those details down as best they can. But in terms of how they feel about their experience and how they feel about just the facts on the page, that's really up to them. And there's a lot of, I think, subjective leeway, and that they have to work with. So,
So let's talk about the piece you read a little bit. What was the impetus for that, and how did it come together for you?
Well, it's the piece is it's about a year old. I wrote it last summer on the occasion of my 35th birthday. So I'm actually 36 now. Hence the title, Summer 35. And at first I really just sat down with the intention of kind of grappling with what was on my mind at that time. And, I'm getting a little bit older, and so I had a recent birthday. So I was thinking about aging. I was thinking about themes of decay, obviously. But I was also thinking about my relationship, which at that point and still is, I think we're in long-term relationship territory now. My partner Maggie and I have been together 6 years now. So at the time it was 5 years. And so I think I was trying to wrestle with, what it means to age together, in a relationship and negotiate and recalibrate your feelings about yourself and each other, as when you're hopefully, in it for the long haul. And so a lot of those anxieties, I think, and concerns were on my mind. And I went about it loosely. I just decided, I'm going to write this essay in pieces, like in segments or fragments. Hopefully they'll hang together under this loose umbrella of themes. Just try to be as honest as I could with it. I do have a confessional impulse in my writing. I was raised Catholic, so probably has something to do with it. So for better or worse, I tend to, write about things that I want to not just get off my chest, although that's part of it, but stuff that bothers me, from my present or my past, stuff that just doesn't sit right, and I want to somehow wrestle with it on the page, and if not put it to rest, at least see it a bit more clearly, for having written about it.
When I read it, I had sort of one impression of it, and then just now hearing you read it, I was sort of getting this whole new level of meaning, but my own perceived meaning, because I think what I'm experiencing in it is oftentimes we think of decay and decomposition as a negative thing, as things kind of eroding and going away. And just listening to you read, I was definitely getting this sense of not so much erosion as a new level of comfort in yourself and your relationship that is like this other side of what we often think of like, quote, decomposition.
Mm. Yeah. Yeah. Well, that's thank you. Yeah. That's good to hear. I hope. Yeah. She and I are moving in that direction, you know, toward more acceptance. Well, I think that was part of the project, this idea of trying to accept the decay and find, you know, yeah, I think find some sort of comfort in it, because at the very least, you know, we can't really stave it off, you know. I think we can slow it down a bit, you know.
Sure.
But in general, we're all aging and we're all, you know, we're all headed that way. But when you're in a committed relationship, at least you have, you know, someone who you're taking that journey with, which is comforting, I suppose. Mm-hmm. Right.
There's a section in the essay that you didn't read where you compare composing as in like the first part of your life when maybe the body isn't decomposing, you're composing to writing a story, and then the decomposing to unwriting the same story.
Yeah.
Which I liked that visual because it still is, I don't know, it to me it sounds and feels like it still is a work of creation to a certain degree. Like even if you're unwriting the story, that's almost the revision process, which is still working on the same story.
Yeah. Yeah. I think that, thanks for noticing that and responding to that section. Yeah, I think that's true. I mean, there's a work of, you know, it's, I guess when I wrote that bit, it wasn't so, I didn't have so much in mind, you know, this idea of erasing the story necessarily.
Sure.
You know, unwriting, not as erasing it. But I think, revising might be a good word, you know, recalibrating or sort of recasting the story in a way that is a bit more clear-eyed. You know, we all gain perspective and hopefully some amount of wisdom as we go on. So it's the same raw material. You know, you're looking back on the story that you've written thus far, and you know, I think hopefully seeing it with some sort of fresh perspective as you age, right? And hopefully being able to look at it, I think, maybe in a more honest way, mm-hmm. and a more clear-eyed way. Mm-hmm. Because I think we tell ourselves, you know, we can tell ourselves lies to, you know, to keep our own more comfortable version of our own story intact, right? And mm-hmm. I think as we age, I think, you know, for a lot of reasons, some of those lies we tell ourselves tend to break down a bit, you know,
right.
or things that were hidden from us previously or that we just couldn't see come to light. And so there is, you know, a constant revision of our own story, I think, that has to happen if we're being honest with ourselves.
Mm-hmm. Dorian, you're also a teacher of writing. So as a teacher, how does that aspect of your work influence or not, you know, your personal writing?
Well, I've been teaching at Grub Street, which is a nonprofit creative writing center in Boston for, 3 years now. And it's been a steep learning curve. I started teaching a couple years after I got my MFA. I didn't actually do any teaching in my MFA program. So my first seminar class at Grub Street was the first time I'd ever been in the classroom as a teacher. And I was incredibly nervous. And, you know, it's very, very different. As I'm sure you know, I mean, you're a teacher as well. So I'm sure you know, it's very different being on that side of the desk. and sustaining and like facilitating a conversation about writing. And so I've learned a lot, and I think I've had to delve into craft and, you know, talking about craft and understanding craft in a way that I hadn't previously, because I knew, well, I'm going to have to explain this in detail to my students, and they're going to, you know, and they're always challenging me with questions that, you know, oftentimes I don't, you know, have the answers to offhand. And so, you know, I've really had to, I think, start to look at craft in, I don't know, in a deeper way. And I know that's informed, you know, my writing when I sit down, and, you know, and I'm also evaluating, student work all the time, you know, since I started teaching. And so, you know, pointing out, certain moves that the students are making that maybe aren't quite working on the page, and, you know, having to point that out to them and having to articulate maybe why, those narrative moves aren't working, you know, is, I know, has helped me, at least be aware of those same mistakes. I still make plenty of mistakes myself, but I'm probably less apt, you know, to make, certain mistakes that I'm always pointing out, you know, to creative nonfiction writers, in my classes. So I think, you know, hopefully it's made me a better writer and a more self-aware writer.
Yeah, I know for myself, I'm actually not teaching currently, which I'm kind of sad about. But when I'm teaching or I have a workshop in session, it forces me to just be more diligent and dedicated to my own writing practice, because I feel, you know, I would feel like a fraud otherwise if I'm trying to facilitate this workshop and I'm not practicing myself. Who am I to be trying to impart any sort of wisdom or knowledge onto these people, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. That was the biggest challenge, is imposter syndrome. You know, when I first started teaching, and I had, you know, like a little bit of success publishing stuff, but you know, oftentimes in these classes, you know, I would be teaching people who had, you know, were middle-aged or even older, you know, seniors who had lived these incredible, full, rich lives with all these experiences, many of whom really, who were terrific writers, you know, and I'm trying to, like you said, impart some sort of wisdom to these people who I feel like could teach me plenty. So I did have to get over that, and you know, but I think the more practice I've had and the more fully I've kind of immersed myself in craft, reading about craft, you know, I've certainly become more, you know, sure of myself as a teacher, but there's always anxiety, I think, and there's always that sense that you know, maybe I am a fraud in some way. Mm-hmm. You know, I always worry about that on some level, but I've just been, you know, I've become much better at sort of tamping down those anxieties.
Mm-hmm. What are your go-to craft books?
Well, for memoir, Mary Carr's The Art of Memoir just came out a few years ago, and it's terrific. So I use that a lot in my classes. Vivian Gornick's The Situation and the Story is a much loved, craft book, but that's terrific for anyone writing, personal essays or memoir. What else? And weirdly enough, Stephen King's On Writing.
Oh,
which
yeah, I love that one.
I love it too. I put off reading it for a long time. It was recommended to me, and I thought, oh, you know, Stephen King, first of all, he writes fiction. At least I thought he did, but it turns out this craft book, which is actually part memoir,
right,
it has some terrific personal writing in it. It's funny. It's unpretentious. Full of insight. So I think that's a terrific craft book, I think, for any writer at any level too, which he manages to pull off, you know, writing a craft book that I think anybody writing at any stage can glean something helpful from, you know?
I loved it too, for just getting more insight into his personal life, because he's such a ubiquitous writer these days that you just hear his name and you're like, oh yeah, yeah, yeah. He writes tons of books. He's really well off. He's got it together. He's got it all figured out. And then you learn that, well, he started out just like the rest of us, slogging away, putting his manuscript in the drawer because he didn't think it was ever going to go anywhere.
Yeah. 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 It's a very inspiring narrative, and he's so deeply honest, and, I just think he really is a gifted memoirist, which I wouldn't have, I just wouldn't have assumed because of his reputation, because of the types of books he made his career on. But, it just so much humor and, I think, so much sort of vulnerability in his work, but he always manages to make it funny along the way. So
now that we're talking about it, I want to go back and reread it. It's been several years since I read it, so it's worth revisiting for sure, I think. What are you working on now? Do you just continue to do short personal essays, and will you try to compile a collection at some point? Tell me what you're working on.
Well, yeah, short personal essays are what I've been writing since I finished up my MFA. And I was working on a memoir during those years, and I wrote a big chunk of this kind of family memoir. And after, you know, I finished my, you know, my thesis, I sort of put it aside and started working on shorter things, partly because I knew I could kind of wrap my head around them, finish them, hopefully polish them up and send them out more readily than, you know, sort of wrestling with this book length work. So I've been continuing in that direction for a few years, but also lately doing more journalism. I've been writing about national parks for a magazine that covers national parks, partly because that type of writing pays. You know, the personal essays don't tend to pay very much, if anything, right? But I have some personal essays on the table, and a lot of them tend to intersect with pop culture in some way. So, you know, in thinking about the possibility of a collection, I think that might be one way down the road that I would frame a collection, is like these sort of essays that combined pop cultural stuff with the personal, and use pop culture or elements of pop culture as a lens to look at personal, you know, my personal stories. So one that I've been working on for a while, sort of on and off, has to do with this this B movie. It's actually a sexploitation film called Motor Psycho that came out. It's a Russ Meyer film. He was a director, and he's known for, he made a bunch of these low budget, kind of ridiculous films with like big busted women and really sensational drive-in fare. Right.
Okay.
And the reason I'm interested in it is because my great uncle is actually one of the male leads. And it's about this this band of like motorcycle toughs who go around sort of terrorizing this small kind of conservative, you know, square town. And it's just amazing to see, you know, my great uncle as like a young, I don't know how old he was at the time, maybe late 20s, and see him in this movie. You know, he went out to LA, to try to make it as an actor, and he had sort of modest success, over the course of his life. But I've always, you know, wanted to write about this film because, you know, mostly because he's in it. But also, you know, looking at, because it's one of those films that's so it's so bad that it's that it's entertaining. It's almost like it's so bad that it's good. So I've started writing about that, and it I've been for a while sort of wrestling with how I might frame the essay, you know, because I want to, you know, write about my great uncle and my grandfather, who was his brother, and they were immigrants that came over from Italy, and so you know, somehow get the American immigrant story in there, but also wrestle with, you know, this film that, you know, that is a terrible movie, but for him represented, you know, at the time, I'm sure a great success, and, you know, his, a certain, you know, in some respect, you know, his dreams coming true, and him, like, you know, I'm capitalizing on the American dream. So, so that's one thing I've, you know, I've been working with and will continue to work on.
Sounds interesting.
Yeah.
I'll have to look up that movie and I'll see if my husband knows it. He's a huge film buff.
Yeah. It's sort of a cult classic. Yeah.
Sure.
But there was one that came out just after it with, and all it's a kind of the flip side of that movie, because it's a band of ladies who are going around sort of beating people up you know, causing trouble, and it's called Faster Pussycat Kill Kill.
Oh my gosh.
Yeah, totally ridiculous, but
that's horrible. That is horrible.
So, yeah. Yeah, they're really just really bad, really bad movies, but they really have a reputation as cult classics, especially that second one.
Yeah.
Because they're just so sensational and ridiculous.
Yeah. Well, it sounds really interesting. So I'll look forward to seeing what you have to say about it when the essay is published. Well, thanks for your time today, Dorian. I really appreciate it. Where can listeners find more about you and your work online?
I have a website, which is just dorianfox.com. So.
Excellent. Well, be sure to include that in the show notes for this episode. And thanks again for joining me.
Yeah, thanks so much, Jenna. Yeah, this was really great to talk to you. I appreciate you having me on.
That was Dorian Fox. Visit him online at dorianfox.com. Find that link and all the info from this episode in the show notes at moretothestorypodcast.com. And of course, don't forget to check out my audio course, CNF 101, if you're interested in learning more about creative nonfiction. You can sign up online from my website at janamarlise.com/CNF101 course. It's a 6-week email course, which means when you sign up, you'll get a lesson emailed to you once a week for 6 weeks. And that email includes the audio that you can download and listen to as often as you like, reading material, summary of the lesson, as well as homework for the week. It's a great way to learn more about the genre, read examples of all the different forms of creative nonfiction, practice writing in the different forms. You'll have access to the course material for future reference and access to a private Facebook group with other course participants. And of course, you'll become familiar with resources for continuing to explore the genre. Check it out at janamarlise.com/CNF101 course. I hope you'll join me. I would love nothing more than to support your journey of telling true stories. Next time on More to the Story, I talk with Liz Stevens about living in the desert and the places that shape us as people and writers. To subscribe to this podcast, go to itunes.com/moretothestory. And while you're there, leave a review. I love feedback, I love hearing from you, and it helps with the ratings. More to the Story is produced out of my home office in Sacramento, California, with technical and audio support from TJ Santoro. Special thanks to my husband, Jeremy Marin, who wrote and performed the theme song. You can visit us online at moretothestorypodcast.com. Follow Under the Gumtree on Twitter and Instagram at @UnderGumtree. I'm Jana Marlise Marin, just Jana on Twitter, Jana Marlise everywhere else. Thanks for listening, and I'll talk to you soon on the next episode of More to the Story.
Tell me a story, tell me true. I want to know what happened to you. the stars are all out and the night is so blue. Tell me a story and I'll tell mine to you. Sitting on the balcony, drinking up our wine, talking about the way that we used to live our lives. The words in the books, man, they're nothing but lines. I look into your eyes and you look into mine. You say, tell me a story, tell me true. I wanna know what happened to you. The stars are all out and the night is so blue.